was with the Voyager mission. None of these missions would have been as advanced as they are now if it wasn't for, for that momentum that they had with the Apollo mission.
Understand. So you could say one of the fallouts is a better intercontinental ballistic missiles, and synchronous, that didn't go anywhere, so to speak. When you've got a formidable enough weapon, you don't have to use it. If you carry a big enough stick, you don't have to swing it, so to speak. And so some of those weapons are nice, and there are quite a few people who think that the existence of those weapons, those so-called war machines, kept us out of major wars. Well, we're in a different kind of a war now. Things have changed a whole lot. Enough of that. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who had questions. Mel, I know you've got a mailbag, and I'll bet you've received a couple of requests for information. So why don't you choose one of the goodies, one of the juicy ones. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Yes, very positive. Some of the few positives that we get are especially directed towards Paul on the email. Some of the negatives, unfortunately, a lot of negatives are towards myself and you, Dick. So I think we are very fortunate to have Paul aboard every year. Yeah, let's see. One of the interesting parts of that program on 13 was that there was an excellent use of Doppler, with the problem they had with the two satellites not being able to talk to each other, that they finally came up with the answer, and it was the Doppler effect fixed. Did you happen to hear that part? Over.
I sure did. And it's very similar to what occurred on the Apollo program. Somewhat similar situation occurred during a Apollo 13. When the Huygens probe disconnected itself by way of the explosive bolt from the Cassini spacecraft and headed for the moon called Titan, because it went on path A and Cassini went on path B and they were separating from each other at some ridiculous number of miles per hour, whatever signals were transmitted by Huygens would be received at a lower or higher frequency. I think it was a lower frequency because the two spacecraft were separating from each other. The receiver on board only had a limited tuning range, and an error had occurred in that someone had not anticipated the magnitude of the Doppler. Therefore, all of this valuable data coming from Huygens would have been transmitted on a frequency that Cassini was not listening to. And so this stuff would be going into the circular file, so to speak, going out into space, and nobody's receiving it. The biggest thing we've got that's completely steerable is the very large 330-foot diameter radio telescope that's at Green Bank, West Virginia. I was there during its construction. It's called the, can't think of the name of it. It was called the GBT at the time, Great Big Telescope, or the Green Bank Telescope. But now, I think it's called the Byrd Telescope, because a local congressman in West Virginia backed that particular program to build this beautiful piece of hardware. So here's the biggest fully steerable radio telescope on Earth, and they listened directly. They eavesdropped on the Huygens probe and heard the carrier directly. It's only a few milliwatt signal, which was intended to go the short distance over to Cassini, and Cassini acts as a repeater to boost the signal and then send it down on their great big dish to Goldstone, for instance, and then send it back to Earth. And so that very weak signal from Huygens was picked up directly by the Green Bank telescope, and it was such a weak signal they could hear the carrier, they could prove to themselves that the spacecraft was alive, that it had landed and not destroyed itself, and was still transmitting. That was very valuable information, because all the data that was a store and forward phenomenon with reference to the Cassini, Cassini was busily storing the next few hours worth of data, and eventually, when they get around to it, was going to transmit it back home. And so you got all these scientists over there at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory chewing their nails for quite a few hours saying, did this thing survive? Because you've got a ridiculous number of hours of delay time between Saturn and Earth just because of the roughly 1 billion miles separation between the two. So, yeah, you had multiple delays there. But that part was exciting. So what they had to do, they couldn't redesign the receiver because it had already been launched, and they couldn't tune it far enough. So they reoriented the mission. They did a rocket burn in such a way that the rate of separation between Huygens and Cassini was slowed down so that the amount of Doppler shift was minimized so that the receiver would still be able to pick up the data. And it's awful good that somebody discovered that before the event, because afterwards that would have been an oops or a blank. And you know what the word blank is. It starts with an S. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Good quick question on that topic.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I saw that as well, but maybe you and Mel know, but I was listening to that, and the guy did pick it up a couple of years early. They ran a test. They ran a test, and they said, oh, we got a problem. And then 2 years later, they finally figured out how to solve this problem. Like Mel says, with the Doppler. But I wonder what test they ran. You know, they were attached to each other. So if they transmit, let's say they brought up the transmitter on Huygens and the receiver on Cassini, it would have worked. I mean, they were attached. There's no Doppler problem there. So you think the guy would have walked away and said, hey, this is fine. And then when they launched it, then they would have had the problem. I whoever picked this up, he should get the Cassini Award. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I agree with you. I am guessing that the test did not take place on the real space hardware. It took place on Mother Earth on backup hardware. See, when you develop a really big piece of hardware like that, the final delivered product is not the prototype. You do a breadboard, a pre-production prototype and whatever in a laboratory, and you save all that hardware. Very similar to what happened on the Apollo program. Grumman Aircraft built the Lunar Excursion Module, or the Lunar Module as it eventually became, and the spare hardware is what the engineers were working with when they were trying to save the lives of the Apollo 13 astronauts after the blow-up in space took place. They did all kinds of trial runs on that spare hardware that was at Grumman Aircraft, and that's how they discovered if we flip the switch at this time, we can save just enough battery power and just enough oxygen in that tank that we can keep these guys alive. And it was really touch and go. I was at the Houston Space Center right after Apollo 15. I had built some equipment to allow me to listen to Apollo 15 while we were on the lunar surface. That resulted in an invite that I got to Houston. I had a chance to meet astronauts and talk to engineers. And when I was at Houston itself, I heard a little bit more of the inside story. And the inside story was it was a lot more touch and go. It turns out that the astronauts were literally read up over that radio beam, last rites. They thought there's a high probability this was game over, and that it hadn't happened yet. But they were quite sure that the possibility existed that survival might not take place. So having hardware around where you can run tests with is very valuable. A similar thing occurred on Apollo, where not only did throw what switch at what time to save just enough power and yet do enough navigating. The astronauts had to do their navigating by manual means, not using the computer on Apollo 13, because they couldn't spare the power. Computers in those days took an awful lot of power. But also there was a huge communication problem on Apollo 13 where if you didn't use the lunar module in the normal manner, the frequencies of the lunar module and the frequencies of the command module had some similarities. You were going to separate them, go down to the moon, and because they were many miles apart, the fact that we're on similar frequencies, no problem. But when the emergency procedure came along, we were using the lunar module as a lifeboat because it had energy and batteries that the command module did not have. And therefore, the astronauts literally huddled inside of the lunar module during most of the return mission and used it as a source of power, heat, and life support. However, the communication equipment on the lunar module was not intended to be used in that manner, and so it was the engineers at Australia who did a bunch of experiments to find out there were ways you could retune the receiver so that the transmitter on the command module would not jam the receiver on the lunar module. They weren't intended to be used in that sequence. Let's see now. I don't know who it goes back to. I guess the original question was from Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yes, I remember. In fact, I was there later. I was there at the last Apollo flight. I sat in there, and a friend of mine was the reentry officer. So I did meet a number of the astronauts, went to where they lived, to see those homes that were built around here. Quite a vacation. Really, never forget that experience. Yeah, and that's also, I'd say, Apollo 13. That was really, I think they did it justice when they made the movie Apollo 13. But of course, like you say, behind the scenes, they really had their fingers, eyes, and everything else crossed because, like you say, it was a very good chance that there was going to be a disaster there. Okay, anybody else have any questions or comments before we go on?
Yeah, Mel, WS2N.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Cernan was the last guy on the moon. Everybody knows the first words that were spoken by Neil Armstrong on the moon. Well, you know, how many people know the last sentence of the that was spoken on the moon, you know, when Cernan and Schmidt left on Apollo 17? You know, we know Armstrong is one small step for man, one large leap for mankind, and all that. But how about the last sentence, Mel? You know?
No, I shall return.
No, let's get this mother out of here.
Are you tell me that was actually the words that they were never published over?
Are you serious?
Let me find, if I can find it in my book, yeah, I'll find it somewhere. He didn't curse, though. It's just those words.
And you know that Neil Armstrong said, I'm trying to think now, what words did he say that was a kind of a joke about his neighbor, if you remember the situation?
His neighbor, well, he made, there was a bet. There was some kind of a bet that they made that he was going to be the one that came up with the sentence of what he was going to say. And, you know, the bet was the other guy figured, well, NASA was going to tell him what to say. Is that what you're talking about there?
No. A neighbor said if that boy ever achieves anything significant, it's as likely as him ending up on the moon or something like that. And I forget the neighbor's name, and so he made a statement when he was on the moon reflecting that situation. The first word spoken on the lunar surface was the word Houston. Houston, the eagle has landed. So you're saying the last word was, let's get this mother out of here? Is that what you said?
Yeah, I'll look up. I'll try to find the exact sentence. It was that, if not that, very close to that. That's not the first word that was spoken on the moon. That's another quiz. Do you want to know the exact first word that was spoken?
Well, wait a minute. When you say on the moon, when the craft touched down on the moon, I think the first word was Houston. When a man's foot first touched on the moon, I think everyone believes it is one small step for man. It should have been a man. One giant leap for mankind.
Oh, yeah, no, now you're going to get into all the technicality. And was his foot really on the moon? You know, his foot was in the boot, you know. Who was the first one to touch the moon, you know? It turned out to be the dust when they took their clothes off, but inside the limp. But the first word, right at, when they first landed on the moon inside the craft.
Okay, we're here with bated breath, Paul. What were those magic words?
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to throw it out to the net, but you could do that. But if not, I'll give it to you.
I think you're going to stump the jury on this one, Paul.
Okay, the word is contact. Contact. And it wasn't by Neil Armstrong. It was by Aldrin. It was his job as the LEM pilot to read out all the indicators and things that were going on for Armstrong as he was coming down. There's a probe that gets pushed in when they hit, you know, when they first hit the moon, and the second they touch, he yells contact, and that's the first word. So he's always proud of himself that he got to say the first word, even so he's not known for it.
W-Q-L. And that makes sense, too. That contact probe was there to make sure that as soon as you make contact, physical contact, you begin the sequence to kill the rocket engine, because if not, you could start a bouncing procedure that could make you hop around and eventually end upside down. So I think that the word contact was supposed to be the command, be the indication to Armstrong, who was the pilot, hey, it's time to kill the thrusters. And I know that Armstrong wasn't happy with the place that the craft almost landed, which was a rock field. He decided to drift sideways and try to find something more desirable. And if you actually listen to that sequence, Houston is reading up to him the number of seconds of fuel left. And they're counting down 45, 30, 20, 15, 10. And so it was kind of touch and go. In other words, he was trying to find a more desirable landing site, and he was rapidly running out of fuel. And if you run out of fuel and crash on the moon, that ain't good. Now back to you, Paul.
Oh, yeah. The guy had nerves of steel, and that's why he was chosen. He was in a Gemini mission when they had a big problem. The thing was spinning out of control, and he corrected it. They remember that. They remember when he was in flying bed spring, they call it, the test module. It's supposed to duplicate the actions of the LEM, and it got a little hairy at one point, and it started to crash. He hung in there as long as he could, pushed the eject button, that thing blew up. I've seen that many, many times on TV. He parachuted out. So the guy had nerves of steel, and I'm sure that's one of the reasons he was chosen. I sincerely believe that. I think they say, well, you know, his number was up, you know, they're up to 11, and you know, if there were further delays in the mission, 12 would have had it, you know, possibly, but I think they wanted this guy to do it. I really believe that. This guy was unshakable, Dick.
Yeah, Neil Armstrong was chairman of the board for Airborne Instruments Laboratory while I was working for Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I did have a couple of chances to meet him, and he's quite a humble guy, not a highly talkative guy, and not much of a bragger. Interesting character, a real slightly sullen Midwesterner by my standards. Paul, Mel, you were about to read another one of the mailbags, if I understand correctly. You got it, Mel.
Yeah, Roger. Who on Apollo 13 said, not bad for the lowest bidder?
Okay, you're going to have to tell us.
I can't guess.
You can guess.
I would say it had to be Lowell, because he was a commander.
Right, got it. That's what they came back. His first word. To show you, I can say these guys, you would think they'd be shaking all over after this harrowing experience, that he makes this comment, he says, not bad, he says, but I'm always bitter. All right, very good. Let's see, so we open the mailbag. All right, let me start looking down the thing. I didn't even look at it yet. All right, let me see what. I can find stuff that I can read on the air. Okay, here's a nice one. My friend was cleaning out the garage. His grandfather was a ham. And I found an antenna. It is square, and it's got a U-clamp in the middle with like a bar, that a support bar or whatever goes from one end to the other. It was a commercial-made antenna. I can see some of the writing. It starts, I can see CU or something on it. Can you tell me something about it? I think I may know which one this is. This is back from way back, but I think I have an idea which antenna that is, over.
A Cushcraft square level.
He beat us to the punch.
Okay, everybody gets a cigar. Yep. It most likely was the square low made by Cushcraft. That's what he keeps that CU. That was Cushcraft. Let me think a few words about it. They made a number of models. I think there were several models. 6, 10. I know they made one for the Citizens Band this time, 11 meters. They had a 15, I think a 20, and possibly, yeah, even a 40 meter. They were, you could tell which band it was, basically, by measuring it. I believe the 6-meter one was around 30 inches square, and seated up that way. That was the 6-meter. I remember the 6-meter version because I know a couple of people had them on their car with suction cups. It was a basically, you could mount it a number of different ways. It was a compact, low-Q, broadband coverage, 52 ohm feed. And, let's see, like I say, I have rubber suction cups, but there are people that put them up on masks, they put them up on windowsills and everything like that. And, I would bet you can most likely maybe find some information on it. I guess if you take the measurements of it, you'll find that if it's around 30 inches, that was a popular one. The one with 30 inches square was very popular for around 6 meters. It was Cushcraft's answer to that other antenna that was very popular on 6 feet, called the, what the heck, what would they call that other one, the round one? Oh, gee, isn't that funny? I can't think of the name of that other one they called it.
Saturn 6, or a high spot.
There was a Saturn 6, there was also a hula hoop antenna. I don't know if that was a Cushcraft product. I have in front of me the Antenna Engineering Handbook, 4th edition, by Volakis, V-O-L-A-K-I-S, and all of Chapter 5 is devoted to loop antennas. So if you build a loop less than one wavelength in circumference, as it becomes smaller and smaller in diameter or circumference, the pattern becomes more and more omnidirectional. This is a loop where the plane of the loop is parallel to the surface of the Earth. It will be a horizontally polarized omnidirectional antenna. It doesn't have the nulls of a dipole. That's the good news. The bad news is it's a little bit narrow band. It's a high Q antenna. But it still can be a nearly 100% efficient antenna. So if anyone has ever owned a hula hoop, a square low, a square loop, a Saturn 6 or whatever, you will remember that the tuning of that antenna was kind of critical. If you were tuning up the Saturn 6, for instance, and your favorite portion of the band was 50.150, and if you had a band opening and you wanted to go up to 50.8, I think you would encounter an extremely high standing wave ratio on that antenna. I wonder if any of the Kings County Radio Club members ran into anything like that. No. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is KTY. The one I was thinking of was the Halo. You remember the Halo over?
Sure do. Was that also a Cushcraft product?
Oh, negative. That was, who made Halo? I don't remember. It was, Hustler? I can say, I'm not sure. Anybody out there can definitely tell me who made the Halo over?
High Bar.
Okay, high bar. Okay, yeah, you're right, Rich. You get the cigar this time. Very good. Yeah, that was the popular 6-meter mobile, especially. A lot of guys used it mobile. And I could say it was a horizontally polar iPad. In fact, I had a tuning little screw that you could twiddle on right there, right up at the antenna. It was three-ring halo, Dick, over.
I own one of those. It's in my attic. Haven't seen it in a long time. One of these days I'm going to bring it out. I am thinking of doing some work on 6 meters, the so-called magic band. They call it the magic band because it's got so many different kinds of propagation. Meteor scatter, tropo, sporadic E, ionospheric EF1, F2, D layer, not much D layer, D layer absorption, not much there. But all the E's and F's and aurora curtain and aircraft reflection. The one propagation that 6 meters doesn't have of significance is rain scatter propagation. But almost all the others. By the way, next week maybe we'll go back to the original question that was asked to us by Tony, K2 Mike Oscar, on the subject of what creates the Doppler spread, that sound. I've got a guess as to what creates that. And it's not quite Doppler. It's a kind of high statistics, Rayleigh fading statistics, but we'll get into that next week if Tony wants to. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, this is KTKY. Fine business. All right. Any other questions or comments about halos, guelos, or any of this jazz before we go on? I also, I asked questions of a few people who have emailed me that I don't stand by for further questions on the particular subject. Okay, so this way I will take a standby on promise from now on. All right, let's see, go on to another one. Okay, I picked up an old receiver. Ah, congratulations. Here we go again with the... And has two selectivity positions, a 1.7 GC, class of C, and a 180 CPS with DW. In either position, there seems to be a cutoff occurs within only an 800 cycle range. They have another gadget here that I don't know how it works. It hangs on the receiver. I guess it was added. Called the RST-599. Okay, I think I know what that is, Dick. Over.
Yeah, I don't think I do. It sounds like a Q-multiplier. And maybe the Q-multiplier is continuously being engaged when he's trying to listen to 1.7 KC bandwidth sideband. Back to you, Mel.
Dick? Somebody say Dick?
Yes, W2EWK. Just to get back to that there halo antenna, I believe that's the same one that is made like an L for 6 meters, 2 meters, and I think 440 is it? The one that is still advertising AES in ham radio outlet?
Yeah, I think you can still buy loop antennas of various kinds, but I think you're saying, Eugene, and the square loop made by, why can't I think of the guys out in California? Anyhow, say it again.
The square loop was made by Cushcraft, Dick, over.
No. M Squared, I think, is the name of the company. Yeah, I think it's now called M Squared. I think it, before that it was called KLM. Before that it had another name. Mike Stahl, K6MYC, is the real brains behind it. So the square loop, the squalo, at least that's, I think it's the name of the thing that I own, for 2 meters. It's a black chunk of plastic with a sheet metal antenna inside, which doesn't work very well when it rains. It detunes itself. It's a very high Q antenna, and raindrops in there tune it to the wrong band where you start getting an extremely high standing wave ratio on the frequency that you think you tuned it to. So I think it's the M Squared company, Mel.
Yes, Dick.
Dick, think there's two companies that make it.
And those two companies are?
I don't know, but I got them in my garage. I got the same antenna. I got two of each band in my garage. W2EWK.
Okay. Eugene, we're going to give you a homework assignment. Please come back next week and tell us the brand name of the two that make that square loop antenna. I'll mail back to you for the mailbag.
Okay, final words on it. This is K2KEY Crushcraft, who made the square low. They had that name registered, S-Q-U-A-L-O. Made them for 6 through, I believe, 40 meters. That was it. M squared, then, like you say, picked it up and produced a 2 meter. There was a couple of the Halo, the company High Par made Halos, were making for 6, and then they started making 2 meters and all. But both, of course, are out of business. All right, anyhow. So this gentleman, he asked about this gadget that they had on hanging on a receiver called the RSD-599. This goes back to the 60s. What used to happen, when you used to put the receiver, you had two selectivity positions, the 1.7 kilocycle for FSC and the 180 CPS for CW. In either of these positions, you got a cutoff between from 6 to 50 dB occurs within about 800 cycle range. So they came up with this thing called the 599. It was a solid state little box with transistors, and it was added on to a lot of the receivers. It was actually called the 599, RSC-599. Oh boy. Okay, let me remember what they called it. The audio filter system, Dick. I'm surprised you don't remember this. It was made by a company called, oh boy. I think it was called, Selectronics, Dick. Selectronics, over.
WS2N when you get a chance, Dick.
Go ahead, Paul.
No, I just wanted to give you the reference to where that came from, the statement of Cernan on the moon.
Good a time as any. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, sorry, Mel. Okay, comes out of a book by Harry Hurt. It's called For All Mankind. It's a story of the 24 astronauts that went to the moon. Not all 24, of course, landed, but they went, either orbited or landed, so that's where they come up with the 24. And it does say, before closing the hatch, you know, he did read the inscription on the plaque, like what Mel was saying. Here man completed his first explorations of the moon, made a spirit of peace in which we came be reflected in the lives of all mankind. So that's more or less what Mel was saying. Then it says, then the Apollo 17 astronauts prepared for the next and most crucial phase of that and every other lunar landing mission, their return to Earth. Apollo 11 commander Neil Armstrong would always have the immortal distinction of having said man's first words on the moon, but it was Cernan who would have the privilege of saying the last words. Quote, "Okay, let's get this mother out of here," end quote. Page 252 of For All Mankind. Back to you, Dick.
That's the way a real pilot talks. They got some very strong expressions for real-world situations. That engine on the lunar module returned vehicle is used for the first time on the moon. There's no way to test it per se. If that engine doesn't fire and give proper thrust for the right length of time, there is no coming home. So everybody bites their nails on that particular one. That's a real cliffhanger. That particular engine, there was no backup to it. There's no escape chute. There is no bailout ring, or chicken ring, as they call it. There is no escape pod. It's got to go, and that's it. There's no other way. And so I guarantee pilots, when they get into their mode that I call the gallows humor mode, that's my word for it. I can remember on Apollo 16, Mattingly, Young, and Duke, I think it was Mattingly, was unhappy with the way the oxygen system was smelling. I'm sitting there listening to his conversation back with Houston during the time they're not connected to the network, and I hear him taking apart the instrument panel to try to find out where the smell is coming from. And Houston, in no uncertain words, told him, please leave it alone. If you touch the wrong thing and create a short circuit, there's no way we can go out there and rescue you. It's going to be game over. Please live with the smell that you don't like. So there are times when life-threatening situations come along, and these guys will consider it, well, it's my job. I'll just do what's required. I ain't worried. Back to you for any further comments on all of this, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, very good, Nick. Understood. Their whole life is like that, you know. Fighter jets all the way up, you know, that whole group. Nick, I recommend that book, quite a few other books here. I have one particular one has to do with the Mars land of the Sojourner flight. That was very good, and they described the duplicate machine that they had on Earth here, working on that when it was like what you were saying before. And of course, they're still doing that with the two rovers on Mars. They have a exact duplicate riding around the sand pit over at JPL. So that one is very good. And if you like engineering, that's called the Sojourner, an inside view of the Mars Pathfinder mission by this guy Andrew Mishkin. He was one of the head engineers involved with that project, and what a good story that is. If you ever get a chance to read that, back to you, Dan.
Yeah, these are good books. Each time I was sent out to Edwards Air Force Base, which has the so-called Dryden Space Flight Center of NASA, is co-located at Edwards Air Force Base, and they have a very nice bookstore. And when you buy a book about NASA from the bookstore at Edwards Air Force Base, almost all of the books you buy, the inside front cover is signed by an important person of NASA, quite frequently an astronaut. And I think I've bought about two or three books there that have those signatures inside. And if I was a real smart guy, I'd remember whose signature it was. I was buying the book, not buying the signature, if you know what I mean. Very nice bookstore. Mel, we've interrupted you a few times. Back to the mailbag, sir. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, one word on Andrews Air Force Base area, that whole area. Not for me. The place, I don't know. I didn't feel well the whole time I was there, and for some reason something got me there. I just didn't like the whole place. I actually went to the office job there, where a friend of mine worked there, so. I don't know. I didn't find the place so appetizing, to say the least. Okay, let's see. Did I cover this with the 599, the RSC 599? Yes, I remember that quite well. Very popular item. It's basically, if I remember correctly, it's wired into the AF gain potentiometer of those older receivers at the time. And it was back basically an audio filter system. So, you got the old receiver and everything like that. The battery didn't rust the thing out. Most likely it would still work. Very simple. Few transistors in it. Okay, shall we go on, Dick? Over.
Absolutely. Fire when ready.
Okay. Look. I'm looking at antenna questions. So our favorite subject here. But some of these other things I'm not even going to bother answering. Bring up some questions. Oh, okay, here's something. I have a situation here. I'm a city dweller, and I've got a 20-meter. Best I can do is a 20-meter antenna dipole up there, and it's fed with 450 ohm. I took your suggestion and set it with 450 ohm line. I bought the antenna. I mentioned radio works. Okay. Is there any possibility that I could get on 40 meters with this antenna? Any trick that you can maybe give me that I can even get on 40 meters? Because 20 is quite dead in the evening. And I listen to 40. I hear a lot of CW on there. I'd like to join in. Is there any possibility I can get this in some way, this 20-meter antenna, even to work somewhat on 40 meters? Well, to tell you a little bit of a trick that I remember, but what do you think, Dick? Over.
Even before you use your trick, Mel, we're back to the so-called infinitesimal dipole. If I took a full half-wave dipole on, say, 80 meters, 131 feet long, and start chopping off the end and making it shorter and shorter on both sides, and if I've got a low enough loss feed line, transmission line, and an antenna tuner that has enough hair on his chest, got enough tuning range, I could go all the way down to 1/10 the normal size of a dipole. And I could be getting something like 90 or 95% of the performance as far as efficiency is concerned. Put 100 watts into it, and 90 or 95 watts will be radiated into space. The pattern will not change by an amount that you could measure. The gain will only change by 4/10 of a dB as you go from full half wave down to 1/10 of normal size. It will become very narrow band. If you tune it up on 3600 and you go to 3650, you're going to retune. You move 50 kilohertz and you're probably going to go jump from a 1.1 to a 3.0 Vizwar. 3-to-1 standing wave ratio in 50 kilohertz. It's going to be a very narrow band antenna. But it will work. But it requires a very low loss feed line and an antenna tuner that's got a lot of tuning range to it. Most of the antenna tuners you can now buy might not be able to do it. But the laws of physics will let you do that. You may have to redesign an antenna tuner for that application, but that's one way of doing it. Obviously, there are ways of putting loading coils and extra clip leads and whatever. That's the direct approach, and it's probably the better approach. Put in loading coils end loading capacitors or extra clip-on extra pieces of wire, even if you have to zigzag it around the property. I bet you faced this problem already, Mel, and how did you solve it? Over to you, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, I did a little bit of a different approach. Had a similar situation one time. And basically what I did is I took the two feed wires, two 450 ohm feed wires, and I put them together. And I basically made up a very simple matching circuit for random length antenna wires. And that simple circuit actually consists of six, more or less, rather than modify a tuner for this situation. You make up a simple tuner, make it up on a wood, piece of wood, whatever, however you want to package it. But basically all it did was a coil that the output of the transmitter went to this one side, of course, from the coax, the center of the coax went to this coil. On the other end of this coil is a variable condenser to back the ground. And what you did is you moved these two wires, like you say with a clip lead or whatever, on this coil, and you found out where you could tune it. Just hook it on, different spots onto this coil. And if you want to get exotic, you can get a rotary inductor. You see them sometimes at hams that would work real well on this. The coil, I think, if I remember, was around 75 microhenry coil, and the condenser, the variable condenser was like about 150 to 200 PF, It basically, I think you'd find the circuit basically as a, I would think in the antenna manual, they most likely would list as a simple matching circuit for random plane antennas, Dick, over.
I believe that. So there's lots of ways of making it work. And using the feed line itself as an antenna by connecting the two leads together is a very nice, simple approach. Any piece of wire, any conductor you've got on the property can be converted into an antenna. And you can actually do the opposite. In the case of an automobile on VHF frequencies, any lack of a conductor can be made into an antenna. Where you've got a sheet of metal and you cut a slot into the sheet of metal and make the slot approximately the length of a half-wave dipole. So you have metal everywhere and you have a lack of metal, and that becomes the antenna. Whereas in the case of an ordinary dipole, you have non-conductor everywhere and you put a conductor in somewhere. So the ordinary situation or the complete inverse of the ordinary situation can be made into an antenna of equal performance. You get the exact same pattern, the exact same gain, just the E field and H field become reversed. A horizontally polarized antenna becomes vertical when you build a slot antenna. But that's not what he's asking. No matter how small your piece of property is, there are ways of zigzagging the wire and make an ordinary resonant antenna. But if you've got an antenna tuner with enough range, anything that is non-resonant can be made resonant. And the word resonant applies to not just the antenna. And Mel was sort of getting there when he was using his feed line as an antenna. The word resonant means the radiating structures, the radiating system. When you resonate an antenna, you're resonating the combination of the thing you call antenna, the thing that is the transmission line, the thing that is the antenna tuner, the tank circuit of the transmitter, and the final stage of amplification of the transmitter. That combination is what you're resonating. And when you resonate, you can radiate. And if your definition of radiation is for every watt I put in, at least a half a watt is going to be squirted into space somewhere, if that's your definition, then in almost every single case, you must resonate system first, then you have the ability to radiate. Because radiation is not anywhere near as simple as everyone thinks. A signal has to bounce back and forth with the resonance phenomena in your radiating system, and it's got to bounce back and forth something like 30 times before it's finally radiating the space. You could say you kicked that signal in the tail 30 times before it finally jumps off that wire and says, all right, I know you're serious, I'm going to go out into space. I had this nice warm home on this piece of wire, I wanted to stay there. You have to kick it 30 times before it finally leaves. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, very good. Well, the only reason I said that's simple to, you know, have to modify a tuner, and also at the same time, because there is a relationship between 40 meters and 20 meters in a harmonic relationship, by making it in from a dipole into basically, like you say, using the part of the feed line, the open wire feed line will become a part of the antenna, and using a random simple matching circuit for random length antenna wires, most likely will become effective enough working antenna for 40 meters. Okay, anything further? Anybody want to make any other suggestions about what I just said? Should we go on? Go ahead, please.
KC2QIQ for a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just something that I've been experimenting with lately. I think it's a great solution for that. For a 20-meter antenna to be able to be used on 40 and even more bandwidth than that, is LDG makes a external tuner that can be remotely mounted right at the antenna. And then you can run a nice, beautiful 50-ohm feed line right back to the shack with very low loss. And the tuning is done right at the antenna, and you have a nice little remote controller right in the shack. Seems to work very, very well.
Yeah, the purist wants to do the antenna tuning and the antenna matching, so to speak, right at the antenna. without a doubt, it is the most efficient way to do it. However, for some of us, say for instance you've got 100 feet of tower, doing the tuning 100 feet away is a little bit on the difficult side, unless you buy a special structure. What you're describing, I believe, is a special structure. And is that a commercial product? My first question, Glenn, roughly how many dollars does it cost? And if you wanted to home brew it, what's your guess as to the number of man hours or dollars required to home brew it? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I think if I were going to home brew it, I'd probably want to do something like a vertical version, like using a high Sierra antenna, or something like a, you know, something along that in a vertical line, and then to run the controller down inside the house. That's around a $400 problem around there. Then there's, of course, you know, the LDG device, which is the remote antenna tuner, which is good to about 500 watts PEP. That's like there again, roughly in that $400 area. If you have a Yaesu radio, the interface is direct with most of the Yaesu, brand new Yaesu radios, and there again, it's roughly in that $400 or $500 arena. To home brew it, there again, to motorize it with an external motor is probably not the easiest thing in the world to do.
Okay, it's an elegant solution, Glenn. And when it comes to good theory, you're absolutely right. However, it is my guess that more than half the people who are within the earshot of you and I right now will say that that gives me sticker shock. They're willing to invest $500 into a good receiver. Are they willing to invest $500 into something that makes their antenna work better, as opposed to just throwing up another antenna? I guess that's a function of how far you are at the end of your rope. I mean, if you're in an apartment building and the supervisor of the building will allow you to put up one and only one antenna of a particular size in a particular location, then spending the $400 to $500 is a good solution. For a guy who can throw up some more wire with his slingshot and his bow and arrow and just build other antennas for the other bands, and if he's crafty enough to make them work, he could do it for a smaller price. So I think you see where I'm going with the so-called sticker shock. It's an elegant solution. I think only half the guys would be willing to go for it. You might have an opinion on that one. Back to you, Glenn.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. I know exactly where you're coming from. Just that I found in my location right now that to experiment with multi-trap dipoles, and you know the property width that I have right now. Granted, I'm not even in an apartment situation; it's a household. But my property width is only like, you know, 75 by 100, and there again, I'm so limited with a lot of antennas that I can put up between a beam already, and then a VHF beam, and then trying to add more wire antennas. After a while, I've got to make some compromises, and I guess in HF that was one that seemed to allow me to put out, get a very, very good match, decent performance, without causing a lot of RFI, and my shack is located on the second story as well, so a lot of the grounding issues with being up on the second story are no longer as much of an issue, and the feed line doesn't radiate, because it's kind of like I found trying to tune inside the shack, there's a lot of, you know, radiation problems with the coax and EMI problems, where if I move the tuning out towards the antenna on a shortened antenna, I'm starting to get a lot better performance all the way around. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, if you had a good enough balance at the end of your coax where it joins the antenna, if the antenna is a thoroughly balanced antenna, like a halfway dipole, then in theory there's going to be no radiation of the coax. But the word good enough in the balance is part of what I'm talking about. I think the folks in Massapequa are fairly friendly when it comes to antennas. I'm not sure. Is Massapequa part of Oyster Bay Township? It might be, but that far south, that far away from Oyster Bay itself, I'd like to believe the zoning board and the neighbors are reasonably friendly. If you wanted to put up more wire antennas, I don't think you would get too much pushback. Is that true, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yes, it is. You know, I guess to a certain extent. Right now, probably a tower is going to be the next thing I want to look into here, but I've been experimenting with a lot of different antennas over the last year. I think I've probably shared some of the things I've been trying. and it was just that for, you know, power levels 500 watts and under, it just seemed like, boy, that was one heck of an antenna, and cutting an antenna to 20 meters, which is, you know, a lot of the antennas I was working with, was one of the shortest antennas, and having that antenna tune it right at the antenna, I was shocked at the amount of performance that I was picking up on multi-band, and it just seemed like a very, very nice solution. I still have that as one of the antennas up there, but as far as trying some of the larger antennas, being that they were narrow-banded and then using the antenna tuner to tweak a little bit more at it, I started having to add more and more wire out there, which had plus and minus as well. And then, of course, as I started adding up the kits, the wire, and everything else, I was spending some money there as well.
Okay. It worked for you, and you sound like you're happy, and a certain percentage of the people out there are going to join you. And so, there's many ways of doing it, as we're finding out. Okay, Mel, I think it's time for either more comments on that one or go to the next one. The choice is yours.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, this particular person, I just read his question. He lives in a city, and he says he cannot do any more changing or modifying or adding or anything. Up there at the 20-meter dipole that he was able to put up, and I would assume they're not going to permit you to put a box up there, hanging back up there. You have to support, I assume you have to support this box. I'm not, familiar to the point. I think I've seen them advertise these remote devices, but I believe you have to mount the box up someplace. Am I correct, over?
That's what I think Glenn is telling us. Isn't that true, Glenn?
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, how I mounted mine was with a piece of 5-foot PVC pipe off of the top of the house, and I had to swing down into the yard. I have an insulator in between, and then I swing it further down with a cord, nylon cord, just to suspend it down, get like an inverted V effect out of the antenna. And then the tuner's in the center mounted to a small piece of PVC pipe. But it sounds like in an apartment, chances of being able to, there has to be some support to hang the wire on it for the center feed, and that's usually the nice location. These boxes aren't really that big. They're maybe just a little bit larger than a shoebox or so.
Does sound like a nicely designed thing. A little on the pricey side, but for those who appreciate quality, you talk to a guy who really appreciates a good receiver, and he wants an Elecraft K3. I don't know what the price is, but I'm going to guess it's around, $3,000 or so, Mel? Go ahead.
No, you can buy K3 for less than about half of that thing. And it's, like I say, I had experience with that a couple of weeks ago. Phenomenal. Anyhow, you couldn't put a thing like that, a shoebox thing up there with PVC. This guy has a nondescript dipole up there, and he puts a box up there and all it. Size of a shoebox or whatever, think he may be looking for problems. So try first this idea that I just mentioned with tying the feed lines together and making a simple matching circuit that you can put in the shack. You think that would be better off than attracting more tension up there. The dipole is easily suspended between two points, but to put this box in the middle, you do need an extra support. In other words, you have to add a third support to go over.
Yeah. So for him, choosing a feed line of enough quality that doesn't have too much loss and putting all the antenna tuner in the shack, I think will work. And if he's a crafty enough guy, even if the extremely high vis wire he's going to get, a 20-meter antenna on 40 meters, I don't know the exact number, but maybe the answer is a 15-to-1 standing wave ratio. And most likely, an ordinary antenna tuner will run out of range. However, each antenna tuner, if the manufacturer was smart enough to give you the right kind of a data sheet with it, where he takes a Smith chart and colors in the portion of the Smith chart where the antenna tuner will function, he can easily take that 15-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna with its particular phase angle of reflected signal, and maybe the reflected signal, you put 100 watts into it, 95 watts comes back to you. That's what we're talking about here. but if he adds the right length to the transmission line so that that particular impedance of his